so I wanted him to hear you. If you have something to say, speak up. That's what I'm trying to get you to say. Talk up. I'll try to move towards you so I can hear you. What you have to say is important to me, and I do want to hear it. So be patient with me throughout this week. This is going to be a little more complicated for me. Not so much for you guys, because your ears work great, but for me it's going to be a little more complicated. So be patient with me. Bear with me if I miss something. It's not on purpose. It's not because I don't think it's important. I may just not have heard. And throughout the week, if you ever happen to be on my left side and you're trying to talk to me and I just completely ignore you, it's a really good chance that I really just don't like you here with you. No, but no, really, I mean this. In certain rooms, I mean, I hear it. So, you know, if I don't catch it, you know, tap me on the shoulder, you know, do something, get my attention. So, Hebrews. Who wrote the book of Hebrews? Who's the author?
Hebrews author?
We don't know, do we? We don't know. Hebrews always intrigued me, by the way. He's outside the Bible class, like your age, much younger than us, too. And it's always intrigued me when we get to the book of Hebrews and we don't know who the author is, and that really bothers people.
So and then they talk about it,
and
it
and then they speculate. It's Paul. No, it's Paul. So maybe part of us. And we waste 20, 30 minutes in a class. People are just confounded that we don't know who the author is. And then we'll go to some Old Testament book. And we don't have that happen. We actually studied one of the Gospels, you guys. There's no Gospel that explicitly names the author. Well, we don't have a problem with that. But we come to Hebrews and it tells everybody, we don't know who the author is. We don't know that. We know the Gospel. So it is unknown who actually penned the book, but God's the one who inspired it. The second thing I want you to think about is, what is Hebrews? Why do you call it Hebrews? And I'm just trying to give you some introduction before we kind of get into what our plan is this week. But I think the reason it's Hebrews is because it's written to Hebrews, or I'm sorry, to Jewish Hebrews. And I think there's just no question that the book is written to Jewish Christians. Look at all of the Old Testament in the book. Look at all of this Old Testament argumentation that this writer uses from the beginning of the book all the way to the end of the book. It just is full of the Old Testament. And so I just think there's no question that the ones who are being written to are Jewish Christians. And so they use this title that we know it here as Hebrews. Are you in chapter 13? This third thing I want you to think about is it's not a letter that's just kind of written to a bunch of people all over different places. Okay? When Paul wrote, say, to Colossians, or Philippians, or Ephesians, he wrote to a specific group of Christians in a specific place. Hebrews is exactly the same way. He is writing to a group of Christians who I think are in a particular place. If you're in chapter 13, look at verse 22. He says, "But I urge you, brethren, bear with this word of exhortation, for I've written to you briefly. Take notice that our brother Timothy has been released, with whom, if he comes soon, I will see you." So Paul, so the Hebrew writer, Paul, the Hebrew writer is addressing them. They go, Timothy, he's hoping to come to them soon. So what I want you to remember, it's a specific place that he knows the people. They know Timothy. He knows them. They know who the author is, whoever he is. And I think that's important to know. Back up to the 10th chapter of the book of Hebrews. I want you to see this as well. These Christians, these Jewish Christians, have suffered past persecution. Now, if you're in chapter 10, let's look at verse 32. Right here, go. Read 32 to 36. Everybody
love, you are made a spectacle both by reproaches and tribulations, and heartily while you became companions of those who were so treated. For you had compassion on me in my chains, and joyfully accepted the plundering of your goods, knowing that you have a better and enduring possession for yourselves in heaven. Therefore, do not cast away your confidence, which has great rewards. For you have need of endurance, so that after you have done the will of God, you may receive the promise.
So he speaks to them about this past persecution. I can't tell you exactly what it is. I can't tell you exactly what it happened. But it was something in the past that they had endured. As you notice in that reading, they're still suffering some present persecution at the time of this as well. So, who's going to persecute? Who's doing it? What does it say, who's doing it? It doesn't really say, does it? We don't know. But here's what I think you and I can conclude about this. One of the main arguments he's making in the book is to these Jewish Christians, and he's saying, look, what we have in Jesus is better than what we have, what you have in that old covenant. Right? And we're going to be looking at that throughout this week. So it makes me think that it surely seems like maybe it's Jews, their own people, who are persecuting them. They have to be kind of like Paul. You think Paul's the only one that maybe persecuted Christians? So maybe somebody like Paul, and so I think it's very possible that's who's doing the persecuting of these people of this nation. One of the things I want you to see is Paul going to be in a lot of things with. And that is what he's really trying to accomplish. And he starts right here, and that is he wants them to give a clear picture of who Jesus Christ is. Okay? I've been teaching another book for the past couple of months with a handful of guys back home. I've been teaching through Colossians, and I can't help but see the similarities in Hebrews and Colossians, where the Hebrew writer is just painting this description of Jesus and trying to help him to see that the best thing for these Hebrew Christians is to see Jesus and to understand who he is. Guess what Paul's doing in Colossians? He's dealing with false teachers, and we're not exactly sure who they are. We're not exactly sure of everything they're saying, but there's one thing we are definitively sure of in Colossians. And that is, he's trying to get them to see the answer to all of their false teaching is Jesus Christ. And seeing that in him you are complete, in him you have all knowledge, in him is all wisdom, in him is all mystery, and all philosophy, everything you need is in him.
I got that, okay?
That's what I want. And it's kind of what I think the Hebrew writer is doing as well. They're drifting, and we're going to talk about that. But the thing he's trying to keep to help them, and what he wants them to see, and he begins right in these first three verses, want you to see Jesus Christ. I want you to have a beautiful, full picture of who he really is. And that's what the Hebrew writer is seeking to accomplish for us here as we work through our text here in Hebrews. So, one more thing. Go back to chapter 13. I want you to see this as well. I'm trying to get you kind of paint a little picture of a time frame that the first part that we looked at again. That talks about a past persecution. So that's something that happened a while back. You don't know exactly how far, but it's behind us. Here's something else that kind of gives you a little bit of a clue that some time has passed for these Christians. Look at verse 7 of chapter 13. He says, remember those who led you who spoke the word of God to you, and considering the result of their conduct, imitate their faith. So it seems like he mentions some of these past leaders that have been Muslim. They have gone on. At least one generation has kind of moved on, and you've got another generation that's come along, and he writes to them, now remember them. Remember what they were like. Imitate their faith. Be like them. So that, again, at least gives you some idea that some time has passed since maybe the persecution, and some time has passed, and these have been Christians. Maybe they're a second, third generation. I don't know, but we're in that time frame. And I at least want to give you this thought, and we'll move on from here. It's possible, based on chapter 8, that this was written before the destruction of Jerusalem, because of something he said in chapter 8, when he talked about the old wall, the tabernacle, the temple worship. He kind of makes a reference there that makes me think that it may still be happening when this letter is written, which would imply it had been written at least before AD 70, and maybe not long before AD 70, quite obviously, that this letter was written. And there's some weight to the importance of the letter connected with the destruction of the temple and what's going to happen with all of that, but I'm not so sure about that. But I am sure what he says in 8. All right, somebody tell me this. What's the overall problem in Philippians? What's going on in the book of Hebrews? I've got a couple of things about this.
When you say problem, do you mean a problem with the...
Why is he lying? What's he worried about?
He's worried about the Jews falling away.
Yes. And we're going to look at some verses really quick in a second. But now, here are these Jewish Christians.
And they've been Christians when it seems like a lot of years have passed.
And they're being persecuted. And they're not growing the way they ought to. They're not maturing the way they ought to. And they're in real danger of leaving Jesus Christ, turning away from Him, turning away from Christianity, and in some way going back to this pre-Christian state when they were under the old law and under the Judaism and under the law of Moses and the temple and the sacrifice and the priest. And in some way, they're leaving Christ, they're in danger of that, and going back to this old system. And the Hebrew writer is trying to get them to see that what you have in Christ is superior. And the very law that you're wanting to turn back to is pointing to and finds its fulfillment in Jesus Christ. So why would you go back? They used to give a lot of other reasons why not to go back. But in just in a general sense, that's what he's trying to address here. To keep them from turning back, turning away from Christ, turning away from Christianity, and going back to this old system, the old law. There's still a present danger for any of us to turn from the spiritual and turn back to the physical. We face that, you and I, to turn away from Jesus and that beautiful spiritual relationship we have with Him and turn back to a physical world. That's what they're facing too. I mean, come on. The appeal of the physical is powerful. They've got the temple, they've got the sacrifices, they've got the feast, the priest, the garb, and just everything about the temple that would be so appealing. And for a Jew, that would be the center of their social activity, would be the synagogue and the temple and everything around that. So the draw is powerful for them to go back. And that's what's happening. And this is what he's trying to prevent. Now, here's what I want to do.
I want to look at some verses really quick, and I want you to listen with me, or you can actually turn with me. Job chapter 2 is the verse. I want to just take a quick survey of a handful of really short verses. My goal in this is to give you kind of see the picture of what he's worried about and his concern for these Christians, why he's worried. And I want you to see how he expresses his worry. And he does that in several verses to show us what they're in danger of doing. The reason I'm going to do this is because you and I face the same dangers in our lives. Okay? Are you in chapter 2? We're going to start right here. So, and we're going to go here. And we're going to go here, 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 here. Are you with me? We have 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9. We're going to try to do that right here with you guys. So you're going to read the first one. And when you go second, you got second. And third, and fourth, fifth, sixth. You got it? So we can move quicker. But I want everybody to turn. Go to chapter 2 if you're there. Read verse 1 for us of chapter 2.
For this reason, we must pay much closer attention to what we have heard, so that we do not drift away from it.
What's he worried about in verse 1? What's he worried about?
Drifting away.
Drifting away. Listen to me. We're going to really come back in a day or so and really sit down on those first four verses, because man, you and I need them. But that's confirmed that they're going to drift away. Okay? All right, you ready for the next one? Go to chapter 3. Everybody turn to chapter 3. And we get there, read verse 6. We're in verse 6 of chapter 3.
But Christ has a son over his own house, whose house we are, if we hold fast the confidence and the rejoicing of the hope firm to the end.
If we hold fast to our confidence, what's he worried about? He's worried that they're not going to hold fast to their confidence. That expression is going to come back several times, but especially at the end of chapter 4, at the end of chapter 10. Hold fast. Do you know what a hold fast is? Anybody know what a hold fast is? Anybody? What's a hold fast?
You can't speak up. He can't hear.
Anybody? Yeah, it's like, picture of it. It looks like an end of a cane, so it's made of metal, steel, and it's kind of shaped like a cane. And then the tip of that cane is flattened out. And what you do is you take that hold fast and you have a hole drilled in your work bench when you're working with wood. And you drop that hold fast in the hole, and you just take like a mallet or a hammer, and you just, boom, you just tap it. It takes a little force, boom, you tap it. You are not going to move that piece of wood under that hold fast. It's not moving. And the only way you're going to move it, you have to put tension, you have to tap it again to kind of move it, to kind of break it. But hold fast. Once you put that hold fast, it is. There's a big old man doing it, and he put it on his workbench, and he's built like Scott here. He is big, tall, and strong. And he grabbed that piece of wood and shook it. The whole workbench moved. He couldn't budge it. Then he took his hammer and he tapped it before him. Hold fast. He's afraid that they're not holding fast to this confidence that they have. So he's worried about that. Alright, in that same chapter, somebody read, whoever's next to me, read verse 14. Yeah, go 14, chapter 3.
So we have become partakers of Christ. If we hold fast, the beginning of our assurance firm.
Hold fast to the beginning of our assurance. He's worried that they're not. Somebody, our next chapter 4 and verse 1.
Therefore, the promise remains of injury and distress. But let us fear what any of you see to have come short.
So what's he worried about? He's worried they're going to come short. And later he's going to talk about rather than endurance, the race is set before you. Keep your eyes on Jesus, the author and finisher of our salvation. In other words, don't stop short.
Don't stop.
Don't keep your finish line and quit. We got a lot of Bible examples of people who started to run with God
Asa? 2 Chronicles 15:16-17. Asa, he started running with God, and he got near the finish line, and he quit.
Mm-hmm.
He came short. He's really worried. He says in chapter 12, verse 15, he's really worried that you're going to come short. Here's this rest that God promises. That's eternity with God in heaven. Don't come short of that rest. That's what he's afraid is going to happen with these Christians, that they're going to come short. Let's just do two more really quick, and I want to make a point about two others. Look at chapter 10. In chapter 10, I want to look at verse 35, and then in chapter 10, verse 39. One of you guys over here, I don't care who, read, give you 35 and then 39.
So do not throw away your confidence and
will
be richly rewarded.
All right, now 39.
Well, we are not.
What do you throw away? Things are trash. Things are taken, throwing this away. And he's like, hey, don't throw it away. Don't throw it away. Don't. You're not those who shrink back to destruction, but to the persevering of the soul, to pressing and holding fast, and don't shrink back. Don't let go. Don't throw it away. And then I'm going to show you two more. Turn to chapter 5. In chapter 5, I want you to see some of what's the reason behind. They're not doing well spiritually. In chapter 5, look at verse 11. In chapter 5, verse 11, he says, concerning him, speaking of Melchizedek, we have much to say, but it's hard to explain since you become dull of hearing. Sounds like me, doesn't it? You know, don't hear it. Well, the point is, some of your translations may say sluggish, and he uses that same term in chapter 6, in verse 12, I think. You're sluggish. You're dull of hearing. In chapter 12, verse 25, he talks about how, you know, they're not listening to the voice of the Lord. They're not listening. They're dull of hearing. See, my point, you combine people who are being persecuted, and you combine that with spiritual apathy, and they're not maturing, and they're not growing. In chapter 6, he says, you need to, you know, press on to maturity, move past these things. You join persecution externally with internal weakness, and you're not growing, you're going to have a problem.
Mm-hmm.
And you're in danger. So what I wanted you to see in all those verses are the same things that face you and I. Don't draw back. Don't go away from confidence. Don't shrink back. Alright? Don't drift away. Okay? The same warnings, the same concerns that he uses apply to you and I today just as much as they did for them back then. If you understand that at the end of the day, you can sum up the book by simply saying, man, don't give up on Jesus. Just don't turn from him. Don't shrink back. Don't give up. Hold fast. Keep your eyes on him while you're running the race. If you understand that's generally what he's trying to help you see, like chapter 3, consider Jesus, then you see how that applies to you and I today. Don't. Run your way through the truth. Hold fast. Draw near. Don't shrink back. Because when you shrink back, you said you're shrinking back to destruction. Let's see. Wait a minute. You got that? Is that pretty clear? Now that's just kind of a basic introduction to some of what's happening in the book here. Now I want to look at go ahead and turn to chapter 1 now, because what we're going to do is going to look at the first three verses here in just a minute. And I want to spend the rest of our time on that in just a second. And then I'm going to tell you some of the things I want to do as we move through the book. How many of you are football fans in here?
His use of the Psalms too is always interesting.
Yeah. Okay, good. You mean basketball fans? Yeah.
Yeah, I'm in trouble. I don't know basketball, okay? I don't really know football. I know basketball's around. I don't even know if I know all the positions on the basketball. Guard, center.
There aren't any
guard, center. I mean,
five out there in position as basketball.
Point.
I hate it.
If I ask you a question,
I do.
Who's the GOAT in the NFL? Who would you say? That's exactly right. Everybody knows what the GOAT means, right? Long time. Tom Brady.
I don't think so.
I think that's that word keeps it from out there. He's the goat.
Joe Montana.
I got some thoughts about the GOAT, but here's one thing I'm going to share with you. He is probably the best quarterback that's ever played game. But I want you to think about what's more powerful. Is it more powerful for me to say Tom Brady is the best quarterback? He's best. Or does it seem to be more powerful to say, you know, Tom Brady, when you look at his stats, his touchdowns, his Super Bowls, his yards passing, he's great with Joe Montana. Y'all probably remember, Joe Montana, he's not playing. I remember Joe. Joe got a lot of rings on that thing, but Joe was really good, but he didn't have near the same accomplishments in some ways. Great kid. He's great with Joe Montana. He's great with Dan Marino. He's a great quarterback. He's a much greater quarterback. Troy Aikman. You keep thinking of him. But you see the point? You can just say Tom Brady's the best and just stop there. But it's so much more powerful when you say that and you compare him to all of these other really great quarterbacks that played the game, it just draws out more powerfully how great Tom Brady really is. The reason I want you to see that's what the Hebrew writer's doing. Mm-hmm. He's doing the same thing, except he's not talking about Tom Brady. He's not talking about football. He could simply have opened the book of Hebrews and said, Jesus is the best, to get all the rest. Close it up. Is that true? Is he the best? Is he better than everybody else? But that's not what he does. He says, listen to me. Jesus Christ is better and more superior than everyone. Angels that stand with their presence of God enter his ministering spirits and who act on his will and who laud him and praise him. Angels who are there higher than you and I, but Jesus, he's greater than angels. Moses, the giver of the law, God's man, he knows one of those unique positions in his relationship with God in how what he can give the people of the law. The place he can hold, there's a passage in Numbers where we'll look at later, he pleads like a priest on behalf of the people, and God listens and spares him because his faithfulness and love for Moses. He holds a special place in the house of God. But Jesus, he's so much better than Moses. So are you seeing the point? This is what the Hebrew writer is trying to help us, you and I, to see by just comparing Jesus to all of these various, whether it's angels, the prophets, Moses, the Aaronic priesthood, the Levitical priesthood, the temple, the tabernacle, the sacrifices, all of it. He's painting the picture of Jesus as superior in every way over all of that. Now, can you see? You see how that is? If you've got the superior, why would you go for anything else? Why would you leave that when you've got the best? Why would you give that up for something that's lesser, inadequate, and unable to make anything perfect? Then why don't you turn from Jesus to that?
That's what their days are doing. I'll say the same thing to you. How could we turn from Jesus to anything in this world, anything else than Him? What people do.
Mm-hmm.
So the answer for us is to see Jesus, see who He really is, and that's what the Hebrew writers tried to help us to do. Let me tell you my plan, and then we're going to look at those. What time's class over?
When you're done.
How about
technically 6 minutes?
10 minutes?
Six.
5 minutes? Six minutes? What's impossible? I can't do this in 6 minutes. I'm not going to teach the whole book this week. I thought about doing it.
What?
So he made me second guess myself. I've won it two times, but I realized I think I can do it without one, two.
How would you ask me?
Not the way I like to teach. So here's what we're going to do instead. We're going to break the book up into three pieces, three parts. And if the Lord wills, we'll get all three. I make no promises that we'll finish all three, right? We're going to look at Jesus as the greater messenger, whether it be prophets, angels, or Moses. And then what we're going to do is we're going to look at the implication. If He's the greater messenger, then what does that say about His message? Right? In Acts chapter 2, verses 1 to 4. Second thing we're going to do is we're going to look at it. We're going to talk about Jesus' priesthood in comparison and contrast to the Aaronic or the Levitical priesthood. And then we're going to look at that. And that's going to take us over to chapter 5, and it's going to take us over to chapter 7. And then if the Lord wills and God allows, then we're going to look at Jesus is better than the tabernacle and the sacrifice. And that's going to take us to the end of 8, part of 9, and part of 10. So that's our objective, if the Lord wills. And we'll just see how far we go. But in all of that, our goal is to see the superiority of Jesus Christ. Now, somebody read for me. Read the first three verses of chapter 1, and let's see this picture, this sevenfold picture of Jesus Christ. And whenever our time's up, we'll stop. So verses 1 to 3, I don't care who reads it either.
Long ago, at many times and in many ways, God spoke to our fathers by the prophets. But in these last days, He has spoken to us by His Son, whom He appointed the heir of all things, through whom He also created the world. He is the radiance of the glory of God and the exact imprint of His nature, and He upholds the universe by the word of His power. After making purification for sins, He sat down at the right hand of the Majesty on high.
Thank you. Can you tell me what is just kind of the biggest ideal in those first three verses? What's like the really biggest thing that's being said that really jumps out at you in those three verses? And it's really huge. Okay, I'm not that deaf. Go.
Jesus was appointed heir of all things.
Okay. Can't argue with that. That is a massive point. But I think for the whole book, it keeps coming back. And it begins right here at the beginning to this idea of listening. I think the biggest idea there is God has spoken. God has spoken. And He has spoken finally and primarily through His Son, Jesus Christ. And that's kind of the big idea in these three verses. And then He's going to just kind of open up and tell us about Jesus. But I want you to see quickly before our time's up. Look at the contrast. He spoke in times past. Okay? But now, look at verse 1 again. Just drop down to verse 1. He says, God, after He spoke long ago. So that's in the past. Okay? But look at verse 2. How does He describe it? He's contrasted long ago with what? In what days?
The last days.
So it's way back then, but now it's in the last days. When you think about last days, what do you think about? How many more days are coming after the last days? Yeah, but if
kind of has some finality to it. It's like, we're ahead. This is it. There are days coming. This is it. So he's both long ago, but now in these last days. Okay, let's keep going. Look at this next one here. So, who are the recipients? He spoke to the forefathers, but if you look at verse 2, he's speaking to us. In the first verse, who did he speak to the forefathers through? Say it out loud, anybody. He prophets. Notice that's plural. But in these last days, he's spoken to us, singular, by his son. Jesus, you've got this fragmented way of speaking versus now this kind of unitary one in Christ. Just one. Do you see that contrast? And then one more. He spoke in new ways in the past. Visions, dreams, still small voices. And he spoke all these little fragmented ways. But in these last days, you've got this singular where he's speaking to us in Jesus Christ. His words, his life, and you have one. And please understand, the fact that the apostles came after him and continue to speak the things of Jesus doesn't change. They were still hearing the words of Jesus. And Paul brings that out in 1 Corinthians 14, verse 37, I think, that these are still the commandments of the Lord. You have that one. You see that? And then you've got this description of Jesus. He's the heir of all things. That goes back to Psalm 2, verse 8. Where the king is put on his throne, and then God says to that king that he's set on his throne, that I'm going to give all the nations to you as an inheritance, and the whole earth is going to be yours. Back there in Psalm 2, that's going to come back to you. The second thing, you notice he says, when he describes Jesus, he's the heir of all things. He's the, through him, all things were made. Andrew, go to Colossians 1. Andrew's going to read Colossians 1 real quick. And I want you to read. Andrew, read 15. Colossians 1, go 15 to, how about 17? 15 to 17 gives what we're looking at. Listen here to what he says in Colossians. This is what Paul says about Jesus.
He is the image of the invisible God, the firstborn of all creation. For by him, all things were created, in heaven and on earth, visible and invisible, whether thrones or dominions or rulers or authorities. All things were created through him and for him. And he is before all things, and in him all things were created.
Thank you. I love that. You know, all things were created, both heaven and earth. All things were created through him, by him, for him. He's the firstborn of all creation. He's the firstborn of the dead. This firstborn comes up later in this chapter when we start looking at the rest of that. So you see this idea of he's the creator. And we're going to see later, he sits on the throne that the creator sat on the Old Testament. But now Jesus is there because he is God and he is the creator as well. So, next, let's move on quickly here before our time's up. He's the radiance of his glory. I have a addiction. I love flashlights. And I have a problem buying flashlights. And I've been better. But I buy really nice flashlights and hardly never use them. So if you come to my house, I got flashlights everywhere in the drawer. It's never used. I love it. But I got one that's in my car. It's a Surefire. It's got some serious lumens. Alright? And I love this thing. If I shine it in your eyes, you're not going to be happy with me. But you know what you can do? It is so bright. You're not going to be able to distinguish that beam from the actual light. It's just so bright. You can't separate it. You know, you won't be able to. That's the idea. That's the idea. The Father and the Son, the shoulder, connected. You can't separate. You know, Jesus, you see me, you see the Father. You can't separate.
exact representation. He goes on to say, he's the exact imprint of his nature. There's a friend of mine at church, and he writes me a letter. He takes out hot wax. You know how people take the hot wax? And he melts it on the seal, and he puts his last name initial, like it's some kind of fancy thing every time he writes me. You know, all I do is just read it up old brother. Don't tell him I said that. But he does that, and he puts his family's last name, it has a big zero in the other one. And he stamps it. But you know what? When that comes, and I see the imprint, I know exactly what the seal is that he used to press that on. Because they're the same. He's the exact imprint. So, all right, let's move on quickly to what we've done. He upholds all things by the word of his power that goes back to Colossians chapter 1, verse 17. He holds everything together. And then look at the next one. He made purification for sins. Who makes purification for sins? In the Old Testament, who do we have?
What's that? They put that alarm off three times. Is that what that is?
Yeah, exactly. Three. And so, he made the purification for sin. We're going to talk a lot about Jesus and his priesthood. He's a priest. And you see that he's right kind of telegraphing where he's going. He is a priest. But you're somebody else who is a priest. He made purification for sin. Well, hey, what's the implication of that? What about their yearly, weekly, monthly, daily offerings for sin that they were offering? And yet, he says he made purification for their sin. And all. He's telling you something about where he's going, okay? And we're going to go there in chapter 10. And then the last thing he said, he sat down at the right hand of the majesty on high. So when you think of someone sitting down at the right hand, you're going to see that in chapter 8, verse 1. You're going to see it in chapter 10. A lot of reference to him sitting down at the right hand of the majesty on high. When you think of someone sitting in this majestic state, what kind of person do you think about? Who is he? Who is this? What's he look like? Signal of throne. Say again.
He's a king.
He's a king. Sitting on this throne. Sitting up there at the right hand of God with authority. And he is sitting there, king of kings. So guess what? This Jesus is a priest. This Jesus is a king. And the same God who said, you are king in Psalm 2,
Revelation 6,
is the same God
the 24 elders lay their thrones at his feet.
You are a priest.
Or lay their crowns at his feet. Is that where that is?
Okay.
Something like that.
And if you get the
it's pretty cool.
That will blow your
that
mind.
Is cool.
How can he be priest and king? That's not possible. That tells you where he's going to look.
David Dan and I have been studying Revelation for a long reason. That's even in my mind right now.
How can this God be priest and king? How is it doable? And that's what he
David's
lead
good.
Us to.
David. You know David Dan?
Oh, David Dan?
Yeah. Uh-huh. He's sharp and sharp.
Remember what
he's
David
really
said?
Good.
Just get one thing.
I'm going to do a meeting there in September.
Really?
I was supposed to do it in June.
He is our king. He is the greatest of all prophets.
Great Uncle Layman.
At times, we will answer the question.
He's one of the elders.
He is greater than Moses and Abram.
I really
why is that question?
We did 2 Corinthians, and then we went into Revelation.
So,
good man. Yeah. Good Bible. He knows so much. Because we're going through Revelation, he's talking about
Samuel's bunking at?
Samuel.
Atkins?
No, I didn't know.